Yeah, I like all the books that pretty much that I have on the Radio Cafe, but this one is really good. I have here sitting in the cafe with me Anne Weaver. She is the author of the book The Voyage of the Beetle, A Journey Around the World with Charles Darwin and the Search for the Solution to the Mystery of Mysteries, as narrated by Rosie, an articulate beetle. And Rosie is this beautiful green beetle, and I have to say, this is Anne Weaver, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
This is a wonderful book. So Anne Weaver has written this wonderful children's book, which is a play. It's called The Voyage of the Beetle, which is a play on Charles Darwin's book, Voyage of the Beagle. So how did you, and it's a brilliant and very clever thing, because you take this character of a little beetle named Rosie. How did you decide to write a children's book about Charles Darwin?
It started out as a lark, really. I think evolutionary theory is one of the most interesting subjects on the planet. It's so complex, it explains so much, and so I was familiar with evolutionary theory, and I finally got down in 1999, or right around then, to reading Darwin's own The Voyage of the Beagle, and as well as being introduced to a brilliant scientist, I found in The Voyage of the Beagle a wonderful, curious, enthusiastic, warm-hearted young man that I fell in love with, and that was Charles Darwin, who started his voyage when he was 22. So at that time, I'd been sort of hanging out with a good friend of mine, Jennifer Owings Dewey, who's written a lot of beautiful children's books, and got into the spirit and ended up writing The Voyage of the Beetle just to share my enthusiasm about Darwin and his work, the young Darwin and his work.
So you were introduced to a brilliant young man, and you're talking about Charles Darwin.
I'm talking about Charles Darwin. Not only brilliant, but if you read his own work, The Voyage of the Beagle, it's filled with wonder as he encounters things he's just read about or encounters things that he's thought about all his life, and there he is in the middle of the Brazilian rainforest, running around, excited, thrilled. He won't come in from the rain. He's so excited about what he sees. And that comes through his book for adults, but the language is just a little formidable. It's old-fashioned. It doesn't really speak to a modern young audience. And so I wanted to translate that and let that young man shine through.
And so in your book, Charles Darwin goes somewhere and he picks up this green beetle who likes to eat roses, and so he calls it Rosie, and they travel together and have conversations together for the rest of the book.
That's right, and as I think about it, I think I was inspired by my own reading as a child. I was a passionate scientist as a child, and I read books like authors like Isaac Asimov, who had a wonderful series for young people, or George Gamow, who was a brilliant mathematician who wrote a book called 1, 2, 3 Infinity. And I was inspired by the way that they had written for a young audience. And I think that unconsciously they flowed through me as well as Darwin did.
And so how did Darwin find himself? He was a young man, and he was on this Navy ship. He was the naturalist. What on earth was his purpose?
His purpose, actually, naturalist was the second thought. The captain, James Fitzroy, of the HMS Beagle, was an aristocrat. And when he contemplated a long voyage, at that time it was only going to be a year or two, it ended up being 5 years, where he really couldn't fraternize with the crew. He contemplated a long, lonely voyage, and so he started looking around for a suitable table companion. And Charles Darwin's name was brought up because Charles was part, his family was part of the landed gentry in England. But in order to further justify bringing along this young man and paying him a salary, he was given the title naturalist. There was already actually a naturalist on board, but in the end, it was Darwin who ended up being the ship's naturalist as the voyage evolved. So, and then that was such a perfect fit for Darwin. There are wonderful stories about how he equipped himself with telescopes and barometers and compasses and enormous amount of equipment so that he could take on this avocation as naturalist on the ship. And then as soon as he gets on the ship, after he recovers from seasickness, he gets the ship's carpenter to make him a huge plankton net out of canvas and wood, which he drags along in the back of the ship, collects, looks at under the microscope, and is awed by the amount of minute life in the sea. So he's going way above and beyond what he was really brought on the ship to be, and blooms as a naturalist.
It's funny that he brings along all these instruments, but spends so much of his time taking little things and looking at them with the naked eye.
Indeed, he does. He's got a map table in his cabin. He sleeps in a tiny little cabin, has a roommate, J.L. Stokes, who I believe was a lieutenant, and both of them sleep suspended over the map table in the cabin. So in the daytime, the hammocks are removed, and he spreads out, especially the first part of the voyage where they weren't using maps too much, he spreads out all of his little tanks of fireflies and plankton and fish on the table to examine it. So, he spent a lot of time. I'm sure he used the microscope as well, a great deal. But, yes, he was interested in the macroscopic, which means the bigger forms of life, as well as the microscopic forms of life.
We're talking to Anne Weaver about the book The Voyage of the Beetle. So you lead us clue by clue, and it's so cute because the beetle is talking about the nature of the diversity of life on the planet. And this little beetle leads us through clue by clue to solving the mystery, and you call it the mystery of mysteries. What is that great mystery?
The mystery of mysteries was a phrase that Darwin used, and he borrowed it from an earlier author, to describe his puzzlement over the appearance of new species on Earth. So by the time Darwin appears on the scene, people have no doubt that evolution occurred. He didn't invent it. He explained it.
And I think that's very important to underline.
Yes, it does. Darwin was the guy who explained. He was the first person to give a valid, workable scientific explanation for the process of evolution, and that's his theory of natural selection.
How did people know at that point that evolution occurred? I mean, if you think about, you're just looking around at zebras and goats and dachshunds or whatever, what was the evidence that they already had that they knew that evolution had occurred?
At that point, it was the fossil record. Nowadays, we take a look at not only the fossil record, but especially the evidence that DNA shows us. And that reinforces the idea of evolution and actually helps us to understand it much more deeply. But at that time, there had been so much exploration of the world, an enormous number of fossils had been discovered. And people were even beginning to see that change over time was systematic. And people had toyed around with explaining that. A Frenchman named Buffon had come very close and then gotten a little nervous and backed away from it. Even Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, had written a huge, lengthy, cumbersome poem called Zoonomia, in which he talked about evolution. So the idea was pretty well established. It's just nobody could really understand how it happened. That was the mystery of mystery. How did it happen?
And so you lead us through this, and let's go through some of the clues that Rosie the Green Beetle brings to her friend, Charles Darwin. One is that every living organism is unique and individuals vary even within the same species. Is that something that was an insight?
I think it was. It contradicts the idea of an essence, that each particular kind of thing has an essential or ideal form. Darwin took a look.
So that's the Platonic ideal.
That's very Platonic. That's a Platonic ideal. And when you start to look at the way nature has proliferated, you see that, in fact, every individual is different, no matter, even if it's one bacterium, which is genetically identical to another, certain genes turn on, certain responses to certain circumstances, and certainly in larger organisms, you see infinite variation. And Darwin examined this mostly when he looked at barnacles. So there's the great story of his dissecting barnacles for 8 years, to the point where I've told this story before, and it's a popular one. His little boy goes to a friend's house on a play date, a new friend, and the little boy looks around at the house, and he says, but where does your dad do his barnacles? So Darwin was looking at individual barnacles to get an idea of the degree and the limits of variation within species. And that, and so his insight applied not only to barnacles, to people, to all of the living organisms on the planet. And that's essential, because natural selection has to select. What does it select? If everything were exactly the same, there's nothing to choose. Natural selection picks out of different variables what works in a given situation. And that's the essence of natural selection. So that's why that insight was so vital.
It's interesting. Explain natural selection a little bit more, because when you say natural selection has to select, you make it sound like it's a force of its own that has like a finger that's pointing to some and then pushing other ones out.
What is true about this planet is it's always changing. And if you go back to the really kind of basic dynamics of continental drift, what that ends up doing is it ends up changing climates, it ends up changing weather systems, it ends up changing soils, it ends up changing environments all over the Earth all the time.
So there's continental drift, there's also volcanoes.
And volcanoes,
meteorites,
which are related
earthquakes,
to that. So you have this huge amount of change on Earth. Nothing ever, ever, ever stays the same. And so if you just had one kind of organism sitting on every continent, when things changed, that organism would no longer be able to function or survive, or that group of organisms, those populations and those communities of organisms couldn't survive. So there has to be a way for populations to shift and adapt to changing environments. So you have a mixed population of individuals. Some, for example, may have a different kind of coloring, or this is a great example I just read in one of the science newses about cichlid fish in Victorian lakes. So the Victorian, there's a string of lakes that go up and down Africa. And they have the most diversity of these little fishes called cichlid fishes on the planet. And it turns out that those cichlid fishes have adapted their color vision, that different species see a different range of color. So that if they live in murky waters, they can find each other. And if they live in clearer waters, they can find each other. And this adaptation occurred because those environments and those lakes changed so much. So an individual who might have been able to see a little bit better in murky water would have had more offspring, because it could have easily found more a mate. And an individual living in clearer water would have a different visual spectrum and be able to find mates there. And they then would have more offspring, and those offspring would inherit those traits that pass on from generation to generation. So that's one example that was just discovered recently and written about recently. But that's true of species, all of us. It's true of all of us.
And so what happens is we all have different traits, and as the environment changes, some traits become a lot more useful.
Some fit better into the changing environment. That's right.
We're talking to Anne Weaver about the book, children's book and children of all ages book, Voyage of the Beetle. And we're talking about this marvelous book. I just love this book. I read every word of it. It's called The Voyage of the Beetle, and it's especially a good thing that, it's a good gift for you to give to yourself, or if you know any curious little children. What would you say? This is for, what, third graders and up?
You could, third or fourth graders and up. It's you could certainly read it to a smaller child, because the pictures that George Lawrence drew are so beautiful.
They are beautiful indeed. It feels like a Victorian children's book, really, in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. I think that unconsciously inspired me, is the ones I read growing up.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Another idea that we take for granted, but with this book, we kind of relive the discovery of it, and that is that creatures are descended from creatures very different from themselves.
We're all descended. Every living being on Earth is descended from some original, simple
cell.
Form. Cell. That's right. Which makes us all one family. It makes every living being on the Earth part of the same huge family. So as billions of years have gone by from that original cell, there's been plenty of time for dramatic changes to take place. And one of the really remarkable changes was when cells got together and started to cooperate to make complicated beings like ourselves.
Do you ever think about the analogies to social structures? In other words,
yes.
When cells come together to cooperate, it's kind of like people coming together and forming a village or something like that.
Exactly.
Is that a real analogy, or is that just a sort of silly poetic?
It works for me in that nature's full of what we call altruism, where you have individuals giving up part of their individual benefit in order to collaborate and end up mutually benefiting whole communities. So that's really common, and I think people doing it is an extension of that. So for me, that doesn't seem very poetic at all, that you can have a division of labor, for example, when you have large groups collaborating. You can have more protection. You can have more flexibility in behavior. So I think it's a great analogy.
And so on some level, a town is an organism.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it is. And the people who understand complexity theory could take this much further than I can. But yes, I think that's a really good analogy.
So back to what you were talking about, we have a changing environment, and the kind of changes that we have on the Earth, we humans like to call them disasters, like earthquakes and so on. But in evolution, they're just phenomena.
Exactly. And actually, they're essential phenomena. They're the phenomena that keep the pot churning. They're the phenomena that keep things interesting. They're the phenomena that are the heart of creativity. So when things change and adapt and something new appears, then you have, and you've just, something really exciting and profound has gone on. The reason that it's an issue for us is we take it so personally, that I really don't want a big drought here in Santa Fe, but that's only the next 40 years of my life in comparison to a few billion years. So taking it personally is what makes the difference, and that's why we call it a disaster, because we have this limited perspective, legitimately limited perspective on change.
When you talk about creativity and you look at the process of evolution and you look at this incredible array, which Charles Darwin himself, this array of life, found magnificent and truly awesome, it seems that there's a kind of gigantic creativity going on, and the result of that creativity is the great diversity of species. Is that creativity, how do I say this, does it... Is it on the part of the individual organisms, or is it just like the whole thing? I mean, in other words, is some little evolving bacterium doing something new? Is that a creative act?
What an interesting question. From an evolutionary viewpoint, we say that individuals vary. Populations evolve. So when a population evolves, that means a different proportion of individuals with a certain makeup of traits has displaced a different proportion in an earlier population. So it's hard for me to actually look at a bacterium as being creative in a sense that I can relate to personally.
Or a lizard.
or even a lizard. A lizard is going to be more, when a lizard born, a certain genetic configuration really constrains its behavior. A lizard has a lot fewer options. It has some options and some learning opportunities. So once a lizard is born and imprinted by its environment, it's pretty well not going to be terribly creative, because it doesn't, in the first place, it doesn't live long enough to take the chances that creativity might offer. Longer-lived organisms like humans, where we have a huge period for learning and we're protected during that learning period, we've got the leisure for a lot more creativity, and so we've got a lot more flexibility around our behavior. And even, you might say, primates are creative when they solve problems. So I think the less constrained you are by sheer instinct, the just genes programmed to limit you in a certain track, like a lizard, and the more programmed you are, the more genetically you are capable of learning, then you're freed, in a sense, from those constraints. But the thing is, the individual's genes aren't going to change. It's the population that changes.
And so, but the individual's genes are not going to change within their lifetime, but a lizard that has 10 little lizard offspring or 100 or whatever, there's going to be so much variation in that.
That's right. Exactly.
That makes genetic change possible.
Perfect. Yeah, that was a really good description of it. Because the lizard inherits genes from two parents that have been shuffled around in the process of reproduction. Shuffled and shuffled and shuffled, so that if the lizard has 10 or 50 offspring, every single one of them is going to have a different combination.
We're talking to Anne Weaver. She's the author of the book The Voyage of the Beetle, A Journey Around the World with Charles Darwin and the Search for the Solution to the Mystery of Mysteries, as narrated by Rosie, an articulate beetle. I love that long title. That's also a sort of Victorian title the whole concept of the book is explained on the cover. Anne Weaver, what did Charles Darwin learn in the Galapagos Islands that was different from what he saw in the rest of his voyage?
When Darwin went to the Galapagos, he collected birds and other creatures that lived there. He actually wasn't paying much attention at the time. So he preserved them and boxed them up, crated them up, and he sent them back to England. And it wasn't until he got back to England that he realized what he had seen in the Galapagos. So his insight didn't come on the voyage.
Interesting.
His insight came much later when he was trying to sort those birds out, finches and mockingbirds, and he found that what he found out was that the boundaries between species are not rigid. That there was so much variation in one population from one of the Galapagos Islands to another that you could string out the birds and it would be really, really hard to draw a line between one population and the other. It was really hard to say which island which bird came from. So that's one way he came at it. And the other one was looking in the end at sort of the average differences of the birds from each island, where islands where, for example, there were lots of little seeds in the ground, you had more birds with short, thick beaks that are really good for crunching up seeds. And islands where you had more bark, for example, to dig into for bugs, you had birds with longer curved beaks. So his insights...
I was thinking about the beaks thing. It's like having a tool chest full of different kinds of pliers and vice grips.
Good. That's what a good analogy. So a population of birds would have a tool chest, and a population on one island would really have the majority of their tools would be nut cruncher tools.
Right.
And on another island, the majority of the tools would be seed digger tools or bug digger tools. So, and if the climate changes on one of those islands, and this has been observed in the last few years, if the climate changes, then the toolkit changes, the toolbox changes. And so the number of tools on one island might go from lots of curvy beaks to lots of short seed eater beaks in a generation or two. We see evolution occurring on the Galapagos Islands today.
And that is because At a certain point, the ones with a certain kind of tool, namely their beak, is no longer adapted to survival because the climate has changed, and it's sort of like, what would be the analogy? Well, people use the buggy whips. People who make buggy whips are not going to be able to survive anymore because there's no more buggies.
Right, exactly. And so you can see those shifts in population. Yeah.
So this is all another thing that was striking about the Galapagos chapter in your book was that where a creature has no natural enemies, it gets stupid.
The interesting thing about the Galapagos, and I understand it still happens today, is you can walk up to any creature on the Galapagos. A human being can walk up to them, and they don't recognize you as a danger because they haven't had that history of reacting haven't been selected to fear
predators,
human beings,
yeah,
and predators. That's right. And so it's not stupid if you don't have predators.
Well, there was one that was, the iguana. Charles Darwin, mm-hmm, it would come up to him and he would throw it in the water and then it would come right back
it
up to him
right
and he'd throw it back
to
in the water. This happened. He said, that's a pretty dumb animal.
And then later he thought about it and he said, maybe it actually isn't so dumb after all. Maybe it recognizes that the danger in the water is so much worse than the danger on the land, that it lands in the water and it swims as quick as it can back to land. even though there is a danger on the land, it, in the iguana's mind,
such as it is,
the relative dangers are that it'd be better off on land. So I think a lot of times, and it apparently was a pretty clumsy critter, but at the same time, it probably was acting as well as it knew in its own best interests.
And you have, it's very strange, an island full of, or a series of islands full of awfully friendly creatures.
And Darwin loved it. He rode on huge tortoises and walked among the blue-footed boobies. And yes, indeed. And I think that's one of the attractions people have when they go to the Galapagos today.
So Darwin took all of these clues that we've been talking about, you know, individuals that are best able to compete in the struggle for survival, they pass their traits on, the thing about the earth changes, another one is the most useful version of an inherited trait, maybe passed on from generation to generation, and small differences add up, as we've seen with the finch's beak and so many other traits. And he came up with the theory of natural selection.
Right.
When he got home.
When he got, years after he got home. He was a journal keeper. He had several journals. And hints of natural selection theory start showing up maybe 6 or 7 years after he got home. Just hints that he had an idea about the mystery of mysteries.
So he was still just in his late 20s at that point. Early
30s? Yes, he was still a very young man. By 1841 or 42, he kind of pulled it together and he had written his idea of natural selection in letters. He described it in letters to various friends. But he then spent the next 17 years until 16 years until 1858, really, trying to scientifically pull together the evidence to support his theory. Because it was such a dramatic turnaround, for example, from the essentialism that we talked about earlier, that he wanted to have it absolutely nailed down before he brought it to the public. So he went on the voyage 1831 to 1835 and did not publish his great idea even at all until 1858, and then The Origin of Species the next year.
And so how would you paraphrase the theory of natural selection? I mean, we've sort of been doing it this whole show, but our radio listeners are driving to work right now. What's natural selection?
I'll start out with a little definition of evolution. Evolution is a change in the frequency or proportion of a gene or genes in a population from generation to generation. So that frequency of the gene, that means how often does this trait show up in the population? And natural selection hones in on that. And natural selection sorts out the most useful variants of that gene and causes that change in proportion from generation to generation.
When you say proportion,
it means in the finch population, for example, in our toolbox, we have a population of 100 finches, for example, and 90 of them have short curved beaks to eat seeds, and 10 of them have long curved beaks. So the proportion there would be that 90% or 0.9 of the population has one kind of beak and 10% has another. So that's the relative proportion in the population.
And that proportion, when things stabilize, kind of works out to what is needed to keep all those finches surviving.
Exactly. That's right. And so if things change, that proportion will change. According to the necessity.
And the food supply.
And the food supply. So the proportion might shift from 90-10 to 10-90.
Now, human beings are also part of this whole big, great process, and we get born and fight and mate and survive and don't survive and all of that. Is there any difference between how we are and how the rest of the animals on the earth are in terms of these questions of evolution and natural selection?
There's no question that we evolved and that we continue to evolve, but our evolution especially our main kind of evolution right now and as modern humans, so let's say over the past 10 to 15,000 years, has been in our immune systems. So when we think of evolution, we tend to think of dinosaurs to monkeys, that kind of big picture change. Evolution also occurs on really subtle, invisible levels. So, for example, populations that had a greater resistance to certain diseases in the past, say during the Great Plague, are going to have a different genetic pattern from individuals who never got exposed to it. And that has lots of ramifications. Resistance to one disease might confer resistance to another, etc. So we have changed and we continue to change. We are, however, we're really buffered from some of the big physical changes because we have culture.
Yeah, I mean, on some level, I kind of identify with the Galapagos iguanas.
Oh, isn't that great? That's a wonderful analogy because, indeed, we've protected ourselves in a lot of ways from the predators and the vagaries of climate. We're not going to freeze to death because we have clothing and we have fire. Even if we had global cooling, or since we're going to have global warming, we'll find ways to protect ourselves from that. So, yeah, we're buffered. And I think that our culture is tremendously powerful, and our capacity to learn also and adapt really has fitted us for a lot of variation in the environment.
And so any one individual may not be as... it may not be as necessary for them to be, say, big or strong or able to resist the elements themselves because they have this thing that also evolved, namely culture, to keep them safe.
Maybe the traits that are most effective for human beings now are not size and strength under most circumstances, but social skills.
Now, there are some other mysteries that came up while I was reading this, and one of them I was thinking about when Charles Darwin himself was so awed. He took this plankton net and brought all these plankton up and looked at them and said, "My God, they're so beautiful, and there's nobody there to behold their beauty." Beauty itself and our perception of beauty seems to be a mystery. What's that all about? How does the perception of beauty, I mean, is that an adaptive thing that we evolved?
That's a huge question. I'll bring it to you. Actually, yesterday I had fixed myself a breakfast with green chilies, and I thought, what an awesome system that these chilies are making me so happy. And then I thought, well, that's adaptation. We survive because we seek, we sort, and we survive because we have drives to pleasure. And we have also the capacity for restraint, but we're fitted into this environment. Us and the chilies have mutually evolved to mutually benefit each other. So I love the chilies, and I'm going to make sure more chili seeds get planted. And Michael Pollan is the one who really talks about this idea in his books, The Botany of Desire, for example. I think our capacity for beauty is an adaptation that drives us and motivates us to seek, to live, to understand, to incorporate, to appreciate. But I think it's probably more complex than that too. I think we could have
it's a long conversation.
Yeah,
and we've only got 10 minutes left. One of the things I love about it, and it made me remember my own childhood of reading books, is that there's so much room for contemplation. And it also made me think, in other words, you take this book and you start thinking about beauty and about plankton and about your experience of looking at little bugs inside of grass. And it was making me also think that Charles Darwin is somebody who, as a budding scientist, really had the opportunity for long periods of contemplation. And I was wondering if that's built into the way scientists are trained now, where they really have to kind of scratch that out for themselves, or if it even happens.
I think, that's also a very interesting question, and I think especially in academia, there's such a drive, and now academia, I say it's being commodified. It's education and science are turning into commodities, and I think that that is ultimately going to cripple our capacity for wonder. And you're right, if you come into science because of your capacity to wonder, then you have to fight and scratch out enough space to contemplate. And a few lucky ones get to go to retreats and have sabbaticals.
Or be at the Santa Fe Institute.
Get to be at SAR, the Santa Fe Institute. I think for most of us, we're so busy scratching out a place in academia, a place in the world, that we do get robbed of that capacity that probably drew us into science in the first place as children.
So this is another question. Well, again, this book made me think, because I suppose I, like many of us, are more focused on the human members of the great planetary family than on humans and dogs, perhaps, in my case, but than on all these other little organisms that are all around us and that inspired so much wonder in Darwin. But do human societies mimic entire ecosystems? Because it seems to me that when you look at ecosystems and all these different people, all these different creatures filling different niches, when we build a society, we kind of do the same thing. And we've got the brain people, and we've got we've got people doing so many different jobs that we're sort of like, even as one species, we're almost like an ecosystem ourselves.
I think you could answer that in a couple different ways. The first idea is that we in the United States and in, say, industrialized companies have huge populations where there's a vast division of labor. So we do have an ecological way of relating, an economic ecological way of relating. But if you look at small populations, for example, if you look at hunter-gatherer populations, you'll see much less specialization.
Right.
So our ecology, our economics and ecology adapt in a really broad way to the circumstances we find ourselves in, depending on the resources available to us and the size of population that's exploiting those resources. So I wouldn't say in a general sense that our, for example, specialization, which is what you were aiming at, is necessarily universally human. I think that's one way we've adapted to a particular set of and a particular distribution and access to resources, whereas a smaller population or a population under different circumstances would have a different structure to exploit those resources.
And might be, as you say, more homogeneous in terms of the differences in traits that's expressed in that population.
In the differences in behavior that would be expressed in that population. Yeah, so you have societies, for example, where a few of them, where women hunt and men sit around the home fires. And you have lots of societies where the men hunt and the women gather. And you have every single variation in between, depending on things like physical strength, or can you take a baby to it, or is the prey especially able to be startled if you're hunting it, and a huge number of variables that a society will adapt itself to.
Now, this is another question that came up while I was reading this book, and is that why is it that we human beings care so much of the survival of our offspring when the rest of nature is pretty much okay about losing large numbers of its offspring? I mean, these gerbils that eat their children's heads off, and some that will sacrifice offspring that are not adapted, but we humans don't do that.
Under certain circumstances, we humans end up doing that. So,
or maybe that's just
I think it's a societal thing.
More.
We can afford. In the first place, there are lots of people who do sacrifice their offspring. If you just pick up a newspaper, you'll find that.
Right, Andrea Yates, right.
And that's one example. Or in India, for example, you'll see a mother of a girl baby and a boy baby feed the boy baby and let the girl baby languish. So we're capable of that, and because we have the luxury of taking care of every kid, at least it's an option in our society, we can mask that over. That's one half of it. We're capable of sacrificing our offspring under certain circumstances. The other part of that, I would say, from the other animal kingdom viewpoint is never mess with a mother bear, for example. Don't get between her and her cub.
Yes.
She will do whatever she has to. Or most mammals, at least as long as they have very young offspring, will risk their own lives in order to protect the offspring. So a gerbil that eats its own young, you might want to look at the circumstances under which it's doing that.
We're talking to Ann Weaver, author of the book The Voyage of the Beetle. You, Ann Weaver, we just got a moment left, but you have been teaching evolutionary anthropology. What is that field? What does that mean? What do you learn when you're taking an evolutionary anthropology class?
When I taught that class, I started out with what is evolution? And we talked about that today.
So we've learned that today, okay. Ladies and gentlemen. Okay.
So, right, we've gone through the whole class.
The whole half of the syllabus.
And then I apply, then I go through how does evolution work, natural selection, and other kinds of forces to shape life. And then I look at how evolution has shaped human life. And I usually look at our closest cousins, the apes, and who we share common ancestry with. And then I look at our particular human path from starting about 6 or 7 million years ago when we really started to distinguish ourselves by walking upright, and move on to how we humans have uniquely evolved. So everything from Australopithecus to Homo erectus to Neanderthals to modern humans.
Ann Weaver, I want to thank you so much for being here. There's so much more to talk about, but I really thank you for writing this marvelous book, The Voyage of the Beetle, A Journey Around the World with Charles Darwin and the Search for the Solution to the Mystery of Mysteries, as narrated by Rosie, an articulate beetle, of whom there is a very cute picture on the cover of the book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's been a huge pleasure.